Hi, everybody. I'm Jay Worthy, and this is the podcast for anyone trying to inject some adventure, purpose, and balance into their lives. 28 Summers is all about living life adventurously, seizing the moment, and optimizing your life. And in this second season of 28 Summers, I'm building upon the messages in season one with the help of a series of incredible guests who are all in their own individual ways, living life full of passion and adventure. My guest today is Mark Beaumont. Mark is an endurance athlete and holds the record for cycling around the world. In 2017, he did what others said was impossible, circumnavigating the globe on his bike in a truly remarkable 78 days, 14 hours and 40 minutes. In 2018, Mark cycled the Americas from Anchorage, Alaska to the tip of Argentina. His accomplishments aren't just limited to cycling, with challenges also seeing him attempt to row to the magnetic North Pole and across the Atlantic. This is a fascinating insight into the mind of an ultra endurance athlete and a must listen. As always, I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Mark, good morning. Welcome to the 28 Summers podcast. I'm so honoured to have you here. I'm a big fan of yours. Love all the challenges and events you've done over the years, and so delighted that you're able to make time. So thanks for being here.
Absolute pleasure. Great way to start the day. Chatting about adventure, I hope.
Absolutely. So, well, let's get straight into it. I'd like to start, if we can, with the younger Mark. So I've heard you talk about your childhood in Scotland before, and the fact that you cycled across Scotland coast to coast at the age of 12, what was that experience like?
I mean, I guess there's two perspectives on that. The experience at the time was just a ton of fun. It was just a kid going on an adventure. Looking back now as a 38-year-old, you know, it was massively formative. You know, I can now see what that sort of acorn of an idea, you know, could grow into. But at the time, you know, I had no ambitions to cycle around the world. I had no ambitions to make a career in adventure sports. So you've got to put yourself in the mindset of a homeschooled kid who's 11 years old, who's never really left the farm before, didn't really have friends outside of my two sisters. And I suddenly have this idea to cycle. Well, the idea was to cycle from John O'Groats to Land's End, but my mum said, look, why don't you try something smaller first? So that's why I went for across Scotland. And the truth of that is, like, the cycling was fun, of course, going out and pedaling coast to coast. I mean, if somebody fancies a first big adventure, doing certainly if you're UK-based, a coast to coast is such a realistic and yet iconic thing to do, whether it's across, you know, England, Wales or Scotland. There's just something nice about going from water to water and crossing your country. But it wasn't just the ride, it was the planning of it, you know, the getting the map out and figuring out how to do it. And it was going door to door, fundraising for some local charities, and then afterwards getting to share my story in the papers. For a kid who had so little sort of, I guess, reference points in the world. We'd never gone on a family holiday before, I'd never traveled, I'd never been in a playground, you know, I was just this very sort of quiet farm, you know, farm living, homeschooled boy. To go on an adventure like that and to plan it and to pull it off was a ton of fun. And yeah, it's interesting to figure out year on year how that stacked up to be something quite significant, whereas at the time it was just a daft idea.
So, I mean, you mentioned then that you had no idea that you wanted this to be your career, and you had no idea that it would grow from that seed into around the world attempt. How soon after did that idea come up to do something bigger? Was it fairly soon after, or did it take some time?
No, tons of time. I mean, I was I just turned 12 when I cycled across Scotland. I did my first 1,000-mile ride when I was 15, top of Scotland to bottom of England, first solo. And then after school, I cycled the length of Italy from Sicily to Innsbruck. So it was like a 1,300-mile ride. But then, like most people, through university, I was involved in club sport, but I was massively sort of into the social side as well. So I was not an elite athlete at university. You know, I was active. I liked sport. I was, you know, I was involved a lot in sort of clubs and running the sports association, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I was destined to be a professional athlete. In fact, I sold my best equipment. I sold my good race bike. I sold my, you know, my good skis. I you know, I was broke like most students were. So I sort of sold all the stuff that I had that set me up for a career in sport to fund, you know, summer holidays with girlfriends, and just nothing in my mind as a 18, 19, 20 year old was setting up for a career as an athlete and a broadcaster. And yet I'd done enough for about a decade between the age of sort of, you know, 10 and 20 to have a love for travel, have a love for sport, have a love for adventure. And I was studying economics and politics, so I planned to be an accountant, work in finance. And I can't tell you exactly when the idea happened. I think it was when people started to talk about, you know, the old milk round and getting the going for jobs and applying in the sort of my fourth year. So I think there was always sort of this two paths that I was on. There was the homeschooled kid who loved adventure sport, and, you know, I'd been a ski instructor the moment I turned 16, and I was hugely passionate about cycling. And then there was this guy who'd done very well at school, who had then been sort of, without really thinking about it, done a degree which I thought, you know, was the right thing to do. I was interested in it, but it was more a case of, well, you can do it, you're bright enough to do it, just do it. And then I'm in a class of 300 and they're all applying for the same graduate jobs. And there was a natural sort of moment of, well, I can see how this ends up. Oh, I tell you what was formative. I was through Scottish Enterprise. I got an opportunity to do a summer internship over in Boston. And I spent the summer in this company called Liberty Mutual, which is a big insurance company over in the US, in Berkeley Street, Boston. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Still in touch with some of my colleagues from there. But I remember one Friday afternoon, everyone being called out of their offices for one of the vice presidents to do a little speech and say thank you to somebody who was retiring. And they were given a little golden carriage clock. And that was it, 5 minutes of our Friday afternoon. And I was, you know, I guess 20 years old. And I watched this, and I'm sure this guy had a hugely fulfilling and interesting and impactful career. I'm not taking away from that. But I was just a part of that. And I just sort of thought, well, he's got a little carriage clock and there he goes off into his retirement. And I don't know, it was 10 important weeks for me where I thought I was going over there to figure out how I could get a foot in the door of the corporate ladder. And I came back going, I don't want to do that. Like, I'm not saying there's a wrong job out there, whether it's, you know, setting up your own business or being a part of a big corporation, but you've got to want to do it. It's got to be personal. You've got to be passionate about it. And I remember sort of a couple of moments over that summer going, like, I'm giving lip service to this. I'm saying, like, I'm broke like most students are, and the biggest motivation is to have financial security. I remember when some of my buddies were doing those first interviews, I think it was Aldi or Lidl were offering a 40 grand starting salary and a company Audi, like a car. And I remember at that point, your perspective is, wow, imagine having a 40 grand salary and an Audi. Like, that's just, you've made it. And you can completely see with a bit of perspective as a 21, 22 year old, that companies like that are pretty shrewd. They're buying into the, you know, the fears and motivations of students, and, you know, rightly so, they do phenomenally well. But, you know, a 40 grand starting salary in a company car is ultimately the wrong reason to take a job. You've got to want to do it. You've got to be driven to do it. It's got to be something that's meaningful for you. So I'm not encouraging everyone to sort of try and pedal around the planet. But for me, there was definitely this moment, this period of confusion where I was like, I'm set up to do something that I'm not massively passionate about. And I looked at some of my classmates and they were better at it. You know, I could keep up, I got good grades, but like, I didn't have the same spark at that age for what I was doing when it came to the economics and finance that some of my colleagues around me do. Oddly, it's something I've held on to and something that I still do in my business now. I'm an investor in an early stage firm, but I've sort of come back to that after a decade and a half of doing other things. So maybe I've labored the point, but I've not talked about it much. It was a strange couple of years trying to figure out what I did. I remember for 4 years, I had a very stable girlfriend through university, and you know, she was off to be a doctor. I was going to be an accountant, and this was it. And you know, we were set for life. And there was definitely a moment. It wasn't an epiphany. It wasn't a moment in time, but there was a period of time where I was just like, I'm not sure this is what I want. And when I did decide, you know what have I got to lose? Why don't I just, it wasn't start a career. Why don't I just go on one big adventure to end all adventures? And if I've only got one chance, let's cycle around the world. And whilst once I'd made that decision, it seemed pretty straightforward. And I didn't really think about it in terms of what it's become. I just thought, well, I'm taking a post-university gap year and off to ride my bike. But the consequences from that were significant. You know, that long-term relationship sort of broke down quite quickly because I had a new dream, a new idea. And I suddenly found that setting off around the world the first time was not just going to be something that I could do in a couple of months. So the lonely part was the next 6-9 months after graduating, watching everyone getting secure jobs and heading off into their careers, and me floundering around trying to get my first sponsor, getting a really rubbish temp job in an office and just hating it. Fitting training in was hard. Getting anyone to back me was hard. You know, I couldn't even get somebody to sponsor a bike for that first race around the planet. I mean, to think it became a 4-part BBC One documentary series, launched my career, a book that sold, you know, 150,000 copies and is still in print, you know, nearly a decade and a half later. And yet I couldn't get anyone to, I mean, my first sponsor was 500 quid and it was just enough to cover my rent for a few months and to commit to the project full time. But that first year after university, before I could actually go and do it, that's when I nearly sort of gave up on the idea, because everyone I knew had kind of settled down and I was like, I was just at that point thinking I'm getting left behind.
There's so much interesting stuff in there, Mark. I really appreciate you sharing that that story and that background. I had not really fully heard that before. I think first of all, the sliding doors moment that you talk about, that kind of parallel trajectories that you could have gone on, I think is so fascinating, because I think that resonates with so many people. And for a lot of people, they end up on the default path because academically, that's the way they're channeled. So I think it takes a certain amount of bravery to recognize that moment and head down a different path. But then there's also a ton of resilience there, because it's not, you know, often people look at successful folks like yourself and think that it happened easily, but as you just articulated, it's not easy. It takes time. And where do you think that resilience comes from? I mean, at 10 years old, you decided you wanted to cycle Land's End to John O'Groats. Your mum managed to convince you to go coast to coast. But there's this ambition there that's about pushing your boundaries. And then there's this resilience of, you know, sticking at it when you're in that awful temp job and you can't raise money. Where does that come from?
I think the independence of mind probably comes from not having a playground. There was no politics. There was no, I remember walking into the playground when I was, I guess, 11 or 12 for the first time in Dundee in a city. And suddenly, and we're going back to the 90s here. You know, at that time, if you didn't wear Cats or Kicker shoes, you weren't cool. Like, so I walked in with Clarks and they were brown and not black. And everyone else had like a certain rucksack. And I had like, I didn't know, because like I just walked off the farm and I'd worn overalls until that day of my life. And so I walked in with like a satchel bag, and everyone had a center parting. Remember the old 90s curtains? And I had a side parting. I mean, I was this such a socially inept farm boy. And yeah, the playground is such an intolerant place for difference. And I ended up really enjoying school, and some of my lifelong friends are there. But I was a really goofy kid and learned the hard way fast, because I didn't have a primary school. I didn't know what it was to conform. I'd never learned the nuances of fitting in with the crowd. And I think school's an interesting place, because the things which you suppress in terms of independence of mind and expression become the most formative parts of your career once you're an adult. And yet they're often sort of pushed out of kids. So I'm not saying be a rebel without a cause, but I am saying, like, knowing your own mind and, you know, taking action off your own initiatives is probably more important than being book smart. Definitely more important than being book smart. If you're both, you know, lucky you. But I think the fact that I didn't go to school meant, it's not like I didn't care, but I understood what it was like to have an idea and do it, just do it. And I can think of so many examples in my teenage years and early 20s where people thought it was a bit weird that I just did something, even though everyone else didn't want to do it. It's not that I didn't care, but I didn't see any reason. Like, it's not, okay, I'll give you an example. That summer I was over in Boston. I remember seeing an advert. We were put in dormitories in Northeastern University. And I remember seeing in the campus an advert for Shakespeare in the Park. So they do these in the Common, Boston Common, they do these amazing plays during the summer. And I thought, amazing. Like, I'm not a big artsy guy, but I just thought, how cool would that be? Like, go down and, like, sit in the park with a beer and watch in an open air stage Shakespeare on a Sunday afternoon. I thought that would be so cool. And I remember, like, with the rest of the interns, I think there was like 15 of us, pitching this and saying, oh, this looks really cool, we could go and do it at the weekend. And you can just imagine one of the alpha males in the group said, ah, you want to go and see Shakespeare? No, don't. And then, of course, everyone else said, no, why would we want to go and do that? That sounds stupid. So not to be different or quirky about it, but I was just like, well, I still want to do it. I'm going to go and do it. And so it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't, and I'm just giving you a silly example, but I remember going and just loving it. It was amazing. I knew very little about Shakespeare, but the whole experience of just sitting out in the sun and enjoying this, but I was on my own. And one of the other interns came up to me the following day and he said, I really wanted to do that. I really wanted to do that. But the rest of the group, you know, obviously had other ideas, and I wish I'd come with you. But that's an example of something that's happened my entire life. And I just wonder why people care so much about what people think.
But I think you said it perfectly. I think it's a great example. And I think you actually said it perfectly. I think whether we realize it or not, from a very early age, we're conditioned to be part of a tribe, right? To be in a group of people in a playground. And then this social hierarchy gets created and there's an alpha and everybody follows the alpha. You know, I think it's fascinating that your homeschooling background clearly created an independence in you that made those kind of decisions really normal. And for a lot of people, they're not, until they get much older and they realize they don't actually have to conform to what everybody else thinks. I think it's really fascinating. So, well, let's fast forward a bit. So 10 years later, after that start at school in Dundee at 12, you set out to pedal around the world and you know, raise some money and manage to get a bike. What's your overriding memory of that whole experience?
The first time around the world to date would probably still rank as my favorite expedition. You know, I've had the opportunity to make films and travel to 130 nations and territories now, and do a whole series of firsts and fastests. And but there's something about that first expedition, not necessarily because of the ride in itself, but because of, you know, where I was in my career. And again, it's about that sort of formative experience. You can't, by the time you've done something once, you can never see the world in the same way. And I was so wonderfully naive, wide-eyed, and on my own that first time. Things have become more complicated. I've ended up doing a lot more expensive trips with bigger film crews, with bigger teams around me, and they add complexity. And but there was something wonderfully sort of stripped back and raw about that first ride around the world. So I mean, the nuts and bolts of it is I was trying to break the Guinness World Record for an 18,000 mile race around the planet, and I was at that time riding 100 miles a day for what was ended up being 194 days and 17 hours, so just over half a year. So at the time, I thought I was going, you know, all guns blazing. I felt 100 miles a day was next level. You know, now looking back, that's pretty pedestrian. But based on my experience at the time and what the record was, that was considered really, you know, really quite extraordinary. But it was a pace that still allowed me, that the even though it was a world record attempt on a bike, it was more about what happened off the bike than on the bike. It was, where am I going to sleep every night? Where am I going to find my next meal? How am I going to water ration? Especially as I left Europe. So I traveled a bit through and lived a bit in Europe and North America, but I'd never been through like Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, India, you know, across the Australian outback on my own, you know, under armed guards around the Afghan border, sleeping in mosques each night in ditches under the road. I was just put into so many situations. I pick up my first book, The Man Who Cycled the World, and it's like reading about somebody else. I wish I could see the world like I did as a 22-year-old. I was so naive, and it's wonderful. I'm not saying that in a patronizing way to myself. I'm just saying, you know, I needed the friendship of strangers to get through. I needed to figure it out as I went. And it was half a year on my own with a camera at arm's length, just living this journey and growing up. And, you know, for good or bad, I'll never see the world that way again. It was wonderful.
Yeah, there's a beautiful kind of nostalgia there, isn't there? And like you say, I mean, I know you went back and did it again and cut down the time. But as soon as you do that, it's a bigger support team. It's more, you know, more pressure. It's all about the nutrition. Everything changes, right?
100%. I mean, there was over a decade between the first and the second time I cycled around the world. The first time cost £25,000 and I was out there on my own for half a year. And it was mum at home with a map and a phone at the kitchen table. Second time, you know, the project took 2.5 years in the planning. I employed 40 people across all the functions. And in cash and kind, it was about £1 million. So, you know, yes, it's the same thing in terms of it's how fast can you race around the planet. But I mean, by experience and complexity, it couldn't be any more different. I'd say the second time makes the first look like kindergarten. But you know what? There was something, you know, beautifully simple about that first one. And nobody now could just leave university and smash the world record for cycling around the planet. You know, my career coincided with a time when cycling and endurance cycling was really on the up, and I just spotted an opportunity. You know, to break the circumnavigation world record now, I don't know what it would take. I mean, you'd have to be, I mean, I had a phenomenal support team, best I could find. I was very well funded, although of course that's always difficult to figure out. By that point in my career, I'd raced hundreds of thousands of miles. So my own psychological and physiological experience was, you know, one of the best in endurance cycling. So to have the right combination to break that record now, of course it could be broken. Of course it could be broken. But you couldn't just fall out of bed after university and go and do it on your own anymore. Far from it.
And I think I've heard you talk before about how much that record has dropped over the years. So when you first went for the record at 22 to then, you know, a decade later going down to bring it down to it, it's really come down, right?
Yeah, I mean, the record, when I went, so when I first went for it, the record stood at 276 days. The record is now 78 days. So it's come down by 200 days. So my mission a couple of years back was to go around the world in 80 days. But then you're averaging now on 400 kilometers a day. So you're averaging, yeah, about 240 miles a day every single day for 2.5 months, which you got to be a cyclist to understand those numbers. I mean, good cyclists can maybe crank out a 240-mile day, but that's a big shift. Do that the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day for 2.5 months. I mean, you've got to have a psychology, physiology, logistics, and everything's got to be absolutely dialed to break that. So, you know, the team that managed to pull that off and the effort and the commitment to that project, you know, that will always be the Everest of my career. I don't think I can do anything which is harder than that. But that's not a regret. It's, you know, I feel fortunate to have created the opportunity to have taken on my Everest.
Yeah. I love the way that you talk about support teams as well. And, you know, obviously you've got your own podcast, which is bringing specialists from every kind of discipline possible to bear on improving endurance. So over the years, as you've started to take on these bigger projects that have become really meaningful, how have you found the right people?
have you put, you talked about pulling together the best team possible for that 80-day challenge. How have you found the right people?
Well, I'm not going to share any silver bullets here because I've not always got it right. You know, at the start of any sort of startup, if you're trying to be disruptive, if you're trying to do anything difficult in life, then you need to find people who are really bought into the why of what you're doing. You know, you have to be people who judge their time by the impact they create, not just the hours they do. So you need to have people who have that perspective on work. I've made the mistake with a number of people in my teams in the past where they sort of, you know, labor on about how hard they work. And I say, I don't care. I care about outputs, not inputs. Like, it's up to you to figure out how to be more efficient or to make a difference. And if you own your own business or drive your own business, you don't count your success in the hours that you work. You've got to be very, very disciplined. You've got to really understand how to shift the dial. And, you know, if you're just somebody who clocks in and clocks off, that's fine, but you're not going to work well with me. And, you know, I've made mistakes over the years on a number of occasions and had to change my teams. I'm always keen to promote talent. I'm always keen to bring people through and, you know, give people an opportunity to learn and to do difficult things, but never at the cost of the project, never at the cost of what we're fundamentally trying to do. Because, you know, I'm in the business of first and fastest. I'm in the business of doing what other people think is impossible simply because there's no reference point for it having happened before. So you have to have people who are not just about, oh, well, this is what happened the last time, let's try and repeat that. You know, we're normally trying to create significant leaps in performance. So you have to have people who have a real sort of fire in their belly, sparkle in their eye, you know, are disruptive in a positive way, who have the ability to see the world differently and are fundamentally driven. They've got something about them which is about, you know, I always say, if the sum total of your ambition is to pay your mortgage, don't work for me. You know, there's easier ways to make a living. But if you want to do stuff which you look back and think, well, that's career defining, life affirming, that is something which I would like to look back and say I was a part of, and this is what I did. You know, those are the people I try to attract. And it ain't easy.
So when you're leading teams, are you looking for marginal gains, or are you looking for kind of transformational new approaches, or is it a combination of both?
It is a combination, because what I always say about record breaking is, you know, shoot for the stars, but learn your trade. That's a phrase that I always use a lot. So shoot for the stars happens a lot without the second bit, which is learn your trade. And, you know, I have people approaching me all the time trying to do with these amazing dreams, but without the fundamental experience or network to make it happen. So it's this sort of, you know, Instagram idea of falling out of bed and climbing Everest. You've got to learn your trade. You've got to do your 10,000 hours. And once you have done, you know, once you have that knowledge, only then do you have the license and the creative freedom to break the rules. And I'm a big believer in that. So I always encourage people, like, I can write books about this and do podcasts about it, and you can understand what other people have done. But when it comes to the endurance world and the adventure world, or anything in terms of, it could relate to business as well. You've got to do stuff yourself and make mistakes. It's not a knowledge project. It's not a textbook exercise. You've got to live projects, make mistakes, learn, move on, and only then can you. So to go back to your original question, if you're going to create leaps in performance, you've got to understand history. You've got to understand what other people have done and how they've done it, and then you can say, right, I'm not going to base my targets on history. I'm going to do a proper bottom-up approach and try and figure out what should be possible. And then you come up with some really, really interesting targets. So the round the world in 80 days, the previous world record was 123 days. And if you just went out there as an athlete and tried to break that, you, no disrespect, I mean, like, knowing what I knew, I could have probably just gone out there and broken that record without a, you know, just with training and a bit of basic logistics. But to break it by 37%, to take the record down to 78 days, I'm not trying to break the previous record. And if that's what's in your mind, then that's what you'll do. You'll always justify where you end up. And if all you're trying to do is repeat history a little bit better, then guess what? That's what you'll probably do. If you're trying to create a significant leap in performance, you better have a bloody good plan of how you're going to do that and be working off your own script rather than other people's. But that's not, you can't have the arrogance to just think, I'm going to do this in a silo. I'm going to do it without any reference points. It's really, really important to understand and learn from others, but not to repeat others. And I think that's a fine balance that is often missed.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And you talked earlier about physiology, psychology, planning, and all of these components. It feels to me like mindset is such a big part of what you do. That's not to say that the physiology, the nutrition, the planning, the equipment is not important, because of course I understand it is. But you know, I've heard you talk about the fact that you're 6'3", so you're not the classic build of a pro cyclist, right? So how much of this is just mindset and your ability to just frame things differently, do you think, that drives your success?
Well, I guess it goes back to that sort of learning your trade piece. The psychology to be able to even conceptualize, say, around the world in 80 days, or smashing the Cairo to Cape Town world record, the length of Africa, or free riding the world's highest volcano. Like, you've got to have done something yourself to understand how that might be possible. So if you've not cycled around the world before, or not done a significant event like that before, the concept of around the world in 80 days, you're not going to do it as a first project. You have to have had building blocks towards that. So that brings in the psychology. That's the quiet confidence. And it has to be a quiet confidence in terms of your own physical and psychological ability to endure. You got to know what it's like, and you've got to be able to suffer well. You got to be able to think your way through the task. Anyone that's an endurance athlete, anyone that's sort of leading big projects, I think gets very good at fixating on what they're trying to do. So that's, you know, owning it and understanding what your goal is. But then fundamentally, they get very, very good at riding the road in front of them. And I know that sounds blindingly obvious, but most people fail not because they physiologically can't carry on, but because the thought of carrying on stops them. So the never-endingness, the sheer endurance, the hardship, the suffering of what they're doing, you can normally ride the road in front of you. You know, use that as a metaphor for whatever you want in life. You can normally ride the road in front of you. And anyone who is really good at big, audacious, scary goals gets very good at knowing what it all stacks up to be and why it's purposeful, why it matters. And then they're very good at focusing on the road they can see. And the duration of time that exists between that horizon and the end goal, it can just disappear. It's like a giant accordion. It might as well just disappear into nothing. So the psychology around that is fascinating, because if you get your head around that, whether it goes on for another 3-4 hours or another 3-4 months, it doesn't matter, because you're not at that bit of road yet. And I do think that way of thinking about it might sound blindingly obvious, but I think is missed by a lot of people, because when it comes to business, when it comes to endurance sports, you can normally ride the road in front of you. But the idea of what happens over the horizon stops people, and they give up even though they could carry on.
I think that's fascinating, and it resonates so much with me. I think it just becomes overwhelming for people, right? And obviously I haven't done anything even remotely as extreme as you, but you may have heard me talk before, but in 2013, me and 43 other guys, we set the world record for the longest game of rugby union in history. It had never been done before. Nobody had ever thought of it before, and we contacted Guinness World Records, and they said, well, you've got to play for at least 24 hours for it to count as a marathon game of rugby. So we said okay, and we got the ground at Leicester Tigers, and we did it, and we played for 24 hours and 51 minutes, and we set the first ever world record. It's been broken several times since then, but one of the things that was fascinating to me during that was I was without question not the best rugby player on the pitch, but a lot of people I saw around me who were very talented and capable rugby players tapped out way earlier than you would have expected them to. I think because they became overwhelmed by the gravity of what they were trying to do. Whereas if they'd have just kept playing the game, you know, you just go through the motions before you know it, you're 25 hours in.
Yeah. I think that what we're talking about here is really, really important to sort of conceptualize before you start, because it's hard to figure out when you're in it. So knowing that it's going to be hard and knowing how you react when it gets hard, but then also when it comes to the physiology, this is not just about, as you say, your fitness or your form. When it comes to endurance events, whether it's 25 hours of rugby or a big cycle event, you're not trying to go particularly hard in any one moment. What fails most people is either mentally they just give up or physically they injure. And so the idea of performing now, but also keeping, you know, playing sustainably so you can average out that effort over the, is something you have to learn. I mean, I've ridden with a lot of phenomenal professional cyclists who just do not know how to pace themselves. I've got no idea how to temper their efforts. You know, that competitive spirit just gives them an inability to pace. And that's important. And that's before you start to get into nuances like the circadian rhythms and, you know, performing when sleep deprived, or, you know, that graveyard shift through the middle of the night and the rest of it. And, you know, anyone who has pushed themselves through ultra endurance will have to learn these things. You know, sleep deprivation is a torture. You know, when I was rowing the Atlantic, you're 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 2 hours on, 2 hours off for a month, never sleeping for more than 90 minutes. You learn a huge amount about yourself. And again, you can't learn that in a textbook.
That's so interesting to hear you say that. That notion of sustainability, I think, is key. But also, I think when a lot of people read textbooks about performance and they read about, say, things like visualization before the event, a lot of people think that, I don't know, just sounds fluffy, or they don't know how to do it, or they don't necessarily see value in it. But I completely agree with you. And I had a guest on a couple of weeks ago who was in that rugby match with me. And one of the things that we talked about was we kind of got mocked by some of the other players, because in the build up to that game, we would set our alarm clock at 3 o'clock for 3 o'clock in the morning, 1 o'clock in the morning, 12:30. And we would get up and train for an hour or 2 hours so that we got conditioned to understand how crappy it felt to have to get up and do stuff, you know, with no prep and coming straight out of sleep and it's cold and dark. And so I think getting yourself, you know, clearly getting yourself familiar with that feeling helps you then weather the storm a little bit during the event.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a lot of selection courses over the years for expeditions, and it's amazing to see who makes it and who doesn't. And it's mainly about psychology, especially in my years of ocean rowing. I was the filmmaker on a BBC project through the high Arctic called Rowing the Arctic, trying to take a boat further north than anyone had ever gone before. Was involved in two different projects to row the North Atlantic and then the Mid-Atlantic, and all had different varied outcomes and successes and failures. But the point we're talking about is the selection. And people would turn up with big military backgrounds, sporting backgrounds, office backgrounds, but ultimately a wish to take on, you know, this adventure of a lifetime. And over a few different selection courses, we would spend just long weekends doing sleep deprivation and, you know, massive marches and, you know, rowing projects to just try and whittle out who was who. And admin, you know, your ability to minimize faff, your communication under pressure, your consistency. It was very rarely about, you know, those who had the biggest, you know, the biggest guns and had spent most time training. It was normally about people's temperament, and it was normally about people's ability to endure. I know that sounds blindingly obvious, but you've got to have done something relevant. And what I loved about those selection courses and some of the expeditions I've ended up on is when you end up in difficult situations, you know, there's certain people that when it gets hard have a real humor and wry smile and ability to still empathize with the people around them. And there's others who, you know, just close up and, you know, become just, I guess, self-preservation just takes over. And there's a real kinship with people who you can tell can suffer well. And I know that sounds a bit glorious when you're chatting about it on a podcast, but there's something really meaningful about pushing yourself. You know, I know it's been talked about a lot, but life is really comfortable. And I know people have stresses and strains and, you know, kids homeschooling and financial stresses and the rest of it. But really, I mean, on the grand scales of, you know, the history of mankind and, you know, striving and suffering, we don't have a huge amount to physically and mentally push us in that capacity. You know, things where we feel like if we don't make the right decisions, there might be very serious consequences. And it's not like I like putting myself in harm's way in a sort of a life-death situation, although it does happen on expeditions. But it's very real. It's very real when you're getting out your scratcher at 3:30 every morning for 2.5 months. You're riding a bike for 16 hours a day. Those are, I wouldn't want to be back there, and I wouldn't sort of, you know, you've got to want to do it. But I look back and I'm incredibly proud of the team that managed to pull that together and my own ability to just think my way through the task. You know, there's nothing else in life that's that hard. There's nothing else that tests you in that way. And I've been in many situations with many phenomenal athletes that just can't discipline themselves in those really, really hard hours and miles. And if you get your head around how fundamentally important they are and realize that you're going to look back very fondly on your ability to do that, to keep going when it's not comfortable. It's very easy to turn up when you're fresh, you know, train when you're recovered, push yourself when you've got a tailwind. It's, you know, anyone can be a hero when the sun shines. But how you are to yourself, how you speak with yourself, how you motivate yourself when it's really shitty, when you're sleep deprived, when you don't have the nutrition you need, when the chips are down, it might be awful at the time, but trust me, those are the moments worth living for. And you don't go looking for them in particular, but if you're taking on difficult things, they will happen. And I just think they're hugely meaningful in terms of your own journey, not because you want to plaster all over Instagram and tell the world, but because it fundamentally shapes who you are and the relationships that matter to you.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating, Mark. And I think, you know, you talk about that internal voice, you know, being alone with your own thoughts, that it sounds really cliche to say you learn so much about yourself, but it sounds like you feel that that's true. And, you know, getting comfortable with the quiet time when it's really dark and you've got the wind in your face and you've been awake for 17 hours on the bike. Those are formative moments, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that when you go on that journey, when you first end up in that place, you know, you can really sort of go, oh, I'm in that difficult place and this is hard, but it's quite exciting. And sort of the endorphins are flowing and the adrenaline's flowing. And like when you're thrown into a difficult situation, it's quite exciting to begin with. And it's tempting to think, oh, this is hard. This is hard because of the environmental piece. And, you know, this is what I was looking for. I was looking for a challenge. You ain't there yet. You've got to get beyond that, where mentally the adrenaline's gone, the endorphins around it are waning. There's not that sort of fight or flight around it, and it really is now just purgatory. And so I think the initial excitement around when it's difficult is actually when you're feeling good about it and you're positively motivated. And I think real endurance is when you get to the place where you feel there's nothing left and you're no longer excited about being in a hard place, and it really is now the hard miles. And I think once you get to that place, you figure out a new perspective on motivation. And I think that's, unless you've been on very big expeditions or through endurance tasks, it's hard to explain what that is. Because it's, again, I've seen it a lot on selection courses on expeditions where people end up in difficult situations and they go, oh, we're in that place. We're in that difficult place. And they're really good for the next 12 hours. And you've got to get long beyond when the excitement kicks in.
Yeah. So knowing that, when you know, right? So now you've been on so many of these hyper endurance type events where you've really been in that awful place so many times. How do you keep the motivation and the energy up to keep trying these things?
Well, I mean, there's not a moment in time when you've done it. I mean, I sort of said with the, you know, the around the world in 80 days, I don't need to do that again. But every time you come back from a project, there's normally a tangent. There's normally something, that leads to that, that leads to that. Since the 80 days, I've been doing a lot more gravel riding, adventure riding, off-road stuff, you know, less supported. So I would say my career has taken a different path in the last 2-3 years. But if you were to stack up what the last decade and a half has been, looking forwards, there's never been a massively clear plan. I've not gone, well, this is what I want my athletic career to be. Looking back, it looks very chronological. It looks very professional. It looks very sure-footed. It never felt like that when I was doing it. But I think like a lot of careers, when you look back, it all makes sense. And there's a commonality between one project and the next. And it is, you know, use that sort of, that metaphor of the horizons. Once you get to one horizon, you can see quite clearly how it leads to the next. And people always freak themselves out with 5-year plans or 10-year plans or career plans. You don't know. You can't possibly know. That's the wonderful thing about life. There is so much unknown. There's so much you don't affect. So, you know, be passionate about the thing that's in front of you. Be open to ideas and opportunities. And you know, just have a healthy dose of obsession. If you're focused on the horizon you can see, it's like riding the road in front of you. That skill set will become meaningful to what comes next. And I see with young people, that idea of knowing what you're going to be is quite paralyzing. And you know, I had no idea when I was 21, 22. And I still, you know, if you ask me today where I'm going to be in 10 years time, I don't know. But, you know, I'll continue to be interested and passionate about the things that I'm doing. And I can tell you what I'm going to be doing in the next 12 months. And, you know, there'll be a continuity through it. And there's things that I'm, you know, passionate about, but the specifics, you've got to accept in life that there's too much we don't know to be completely fixed in our plans.
Yeah. I love that sentiment. I think that's a really strong message. And I'm really enjoying this conversation. I feel like I could go on forever, but I want to be respectful of your time. So, you know, last couple of questions. One of my favorite final questions, which has become a bit of a stalwart, is, you know, when I'm talking to people that go on epic adventures and endurance challenges like you, what's your must-have essential item, your one kind of creature comfort or thing that you love that goes first in the pack or the panniers?
I was thinking about this before. I wish there was something utterly unique. There's not. The thing which I won't go anywhere without is, you know, a GPS tracker and comms. You know, so a safety device. People go off on expeditions all the time just with their mobile phone and think that's fine, and then it runs out of battery and you go behind a hill and there's no signal. So I always, always, always have a link back to base camp, you know, a spot tracker, or, you know, some sort of Inmarsat system, which I've been in too many difficult situations in the high mountains in the middle of the oceans to ever leave myself out like that. So having a link back to base camp, to my loved ones, to my wife and my mum, is always with me. So anyone going on expeditions, you know, knowing where you are beyond your electronic technology and having a backup when things go south is a horribly boring thing to say, but probably my number one.
I think it's perfect. And there's no preconception of what a good answer is there, but I just think there's so much experience that you have. So I love asking that question. Sometimes it's something kind of funny and it's a creature comfort. Other times it's something really practical and great advice like that. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, the old, you know, photos of the kids, a pocket knife, you know, yeah. A camera to take pictures. I mean, yeah, of course, you know, I take all of those things, but I've been in a few close scrapes in my life. So for me, the safety bit is often missed.
Yeah, that's great advice. Well, look, maybe to bring us home and put a bow on things, the 28 Summers podcast is all about encouraging people to live life adventurously. And for many, that's not going to be cycling around the world or rowing an ocean. It will be something different to that. But it's about mindset, right? It's about creating more adventure in your life. And I wondered for those that are listening who are inspired by your, you know, your experience and your background, if they're looking to break free and become more adventurous, what your top tips or your advice might be?
I guess my perspective on this is, what's the impact you want to have in the world? You know, what do you care about? There's three spheres that I care about: my family, my community, and in my work. And, you know, time is the scarcest commodity. So you've got to sort of step away from your own day to day and think, well, what matters? You know, am I just spending months and years existing and getting through to-do lists, or am I actually prioritizing stuff that I'm going to look back on and is going to be worthwhile? So before you get to living life adventurously, if I'm going to create positive relationships with my family, you know, what time does that take and how do I do it? And that's, to your point, not just about spending time with the kids and your partner, but going out and doing stuff that they can relate to. You know, my adventures, and even just going out during lockdown and going for night gravel rides or fell runs, it makes me a better person with my family. And if I care about them, then I need to look after myself. You know, my community, both locally and at large, you can spend your life thinking it's other people's problems, but, you know, we can all have a positive impact in the communities around us. And again, you just got to figure out in real terms, well, what am I going to do about it? You know, people spend their lives thinking I'll get wealthy or I'll get to retirement and then I'll give back. Well, do these things for wonderfully selfish reasons. Do it because it makes you feel like, you know, in terms of your own mental health and well-being, it's just a bit more worthwhile. You know, I always sort of think, you know, if you can get the arrows going that way and pointing out the way, then the only person you're really helping is yourself. You know, it's like giving Christmas presents. You know, when you're a kid, it's great to receive Christmas presents, but when you're a grown up, it's a lot nicer to give Christmas presents. And that, I'm not saying that as a goody two shoes sort of, I'm just saying, to have a sense of adventure, to have a sense of fulfillment, and I'm not pretending I get this right all the time, but I do have a purpose around it. I do have a plan around it. You got to figure out what's the impact I want to have in the world. You know, family, community, and work. And if you figure that out, you can reprioritize things. And at least, you might be silly busy, but at least what you're doing is relevant. At least what you're doing, there's a clear way for you to say no to stuff. And until you learn to say no to stuff, you're just going to be drifting on the wind. You're just going to be, you know, doing stuff that society and other people want you to do. You got to be in the driving seat. You got to feel like what I do matters because I've decided to do it. And then if adventures and sport become a part of that, fantastic. But it starts with you sort of thinking through, why does it matter? Like, how am I going to prioritize my time? What do I want to get out of life? And if you figure that bit out, then you can start to restructure stuff.
It's really powerful advice, and I love everything you just said. I particularly love the idea, which I've heard from other guests and believe myself, that being adventurous and doing some of the things you want to do and finding out the impact you want to have on the world makes you a better person when you're with your loved ones. I think that's a really powerful sentiment, because I think a lot of us kind of create these fictional barriers that stop us doing things because we worry that means we'll be away from our family and that's not a good thing. So I think that's a really powerful sentiment.
Yeah, for sure. And I've really enjoyed listening to some of your other episodes. I think there is a continuity. There's a commonality between what your guests are bringing to the show. So yeah, keep up the great work.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Mark, your story is so inspiring. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I'm so grateful for your time, and I'm excited to keep watching and see what challenges you go after next. I'm sure they'll be epic and memorable. So thanks again for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
There is no question Mark is an outstanding athlete and his accomplishments are nothing short of remarkable. But he's also a man focused on the details, and I really enjoyed learning how he builds his teams and approaches these Herculean efforts bit by bit. What I love most about Mark is his willingness from an early age to be different and to not just go along with the crowd. There's a strong lesson in there for all of us on living the life we want to live, free from peer pressure. Mark has a new documentary available on the Global Cycling Network, which covers his incredible journey around the world. And you can find the link to this and everything else to do with Mark and his challenges via his Instagram at Mr. Mark Beaumont. I thoroughly enjoyed this episode and I'm so grateful to Mark for his time. As always, if you can find the time, please do follow me on Instagram at One Day Adventurer and let me know what challenges you plan to pursue in 2021 and beyond. Please also click subscribe on the podcast and leave me a review. It helps so much in securing incredible guests for these interviews. That's it from me today. I'll be back next week with another awesome guest. In the meantime, stay happy, stay healthy, and remember to live adventurously.